Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to strike the deal you really want in the workplace, the marketplace, or even with your partner, your kids? Traditional bargaining strategies often focus on logic and encourage competing sides to press whatever advantages they might have. But as my guest today has learned, as a consultant to negotiations among politicians, corporate executives, attorneys, and regular people with seemingly intractable conflicts, there are tremendous benefits to recognizing and responding to the emotions that underlie our adversaries' positions. It also helps to consider less than obvious solutions to our problems and to accept incremental progress rather than pushing for all or nothing settlements. Stuart Diamond is a professor at the Wharton School of Business and Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called Getting More: How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. Stuart, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We should start with a little explanation here, because you make it clear that getting more does not promise we'll get everything. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
That's exactly right. Basically, the efforts by people in the world, when you look at how people act, are generally to do better than yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what's most likely to be acceptable to somebody else, that when you try to get everything, other people push back. And so what the book is really about is getting more for everyone, is finding ways for everyone to be more satisfied, because after all, if you're not satisfied, I'm not going to be able to persuade you of anything. And what I found in I've taught 30,000 people in 45 countries over the last 20 years, from country leaders to secretaries. And what I found is that the traditional ways that people deal with each other simply don't work very well. The threats, the walking out, the use of power, rationality, leverage, alternatives to agreement, they generally cause resentment, retaliation, emotion, and failure to focus on goals, whether it's in the store, with your kids, in politics, and business. And so what I did with Getting More is to spell out step by step a way to do this better, using the words of 400 of the people I taught and showing how this works in a very detailed fashion in everyday life.
So regardless of what we're bargaining over or who we're dealing with, you point out that it's important to understand from the beginning the pictures that our adversaries have formed in their heads about the deal in question.
That's exactly right. Finding, valuing, and understanding their perceptions and emotions, it dwarfs anything else you can do. First of all, it gives you a place to start. How do you know your proposal's in the right place? You don't if you don't know their perceptions. And second of all, valuing their perceptions get people more willing to listen, especially if they're emotional when people aren't listening. So making a human connection is more important than anything else that you can do. And I want to just mention a little anecdote. I had a former student flew up to Philadelphia from Houston, nearby where you are, in a blinding snowstorm here in Philadelphia last winter. Plane was 4 hours late. And when the plane landed, the rest of the passengers were snarling at the flight crew and the gate agent when she came on the plane. And this former student of mine looked at this, went up to the flight crew, apologized for everybody else's behavior, and said to them, you know, it must be a real drag to work an extra 4 hours on a day like today. And when he got off the plane, they gave him $600. They gave him a free ticket, the only person on the plane to get such a benefit, because he made a human connection with them. When you make a human connection with them, they're almost six times more willing to give you what you want than when you don't, 90% versus 16%. So the right answer to the statement, I hate you, is tell me more. Maybe they don't actually hate you, they're just frustrated with the last person they saw. And so it's a great competitive advantage to be dispassionate and to not take the first answer and to find out what they're really perceiving.
And it's funny, too, because you don't necessarily know when you're dealing with someone, they might have much more leeway to make things better for you than you realize.
That's exactly right. And unless you find out, people assume so many things without bothering to figure out somebody else's perceptions. When a mother is arguing with her teenage daughter about going out to the bar in the evening, the teenage daughter is thinking, I want my freedom. The mother's thinking, my daughter's going to get killed.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you identify and value each other's perceptions, you can't have a conversation. And unless you find a way to deal with them reasonably and empathetically, you're never going to get a deal.
Well, Stuart, does that strategy still work in cases where the other side holds ideas that really are irrational or completely unfair?
Absolutely, because among the things I have to start with is if they're crazy, I have to acknowledge the value of their craziness. Because if I want to persuade them, I've got to get them to start listening to me. And when people are emotional or crazy, they're not listening. And studies show that the more important the negotiation is to people, the more emotional they are, whether world peace, a $1 billion deal, or my kid wants an ice cream cone.
Sure.
And so in the U.S. debt crisis, when the parties are demonizing each other, nobody's listening to anybody else. And so nobody's getting the best ideas. And we now have a society, unfortunately, post 9/11, where there's a lot more conflict. And what that means is win-lose. My ideas are yours. When the real value that's added is a new synthesis based on the best ideas from both, which is one of the things that made this country great. And unfortunately, we're now fifth in competitiveness, not first. And I have to believe this is one of the reasons why. So there are real costs to this.
So obviously you want to start with empathy for the other side and you want to communicate that.
Yeah.
Is that the first step to getting them to understand your perception?
That's exactly right, because I need to get the other people ready to listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And until they're ready to listen to me, they can't be persuaded, which means that if I'm in a business meeting and I come with my spreadsheets, if you're mad at me for something my company did last year, you don't give a hoot about my spreadsheets. You want me to make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
You want an apology, a concession, empathy, I understand. And so the notion of win-win is very nice, but it's often irrelevant in important negotiations until the parties make an emotional connection. I actually told my class at Wharton Business School one day that I tell my wife sometimes that she's right, even if she's not, to preserve marital harmony. And then I thought, well, that's not fair. I shared personal information with my wife, didn't tell my wife. So I went home and I said to my wife, honey, you know, I told the class today that I sometimes tell you you're right even if you're not to preserve marital harmony. You know what she said?
She does
that'll
the same
work.
Thing. Oh,
she said,
that'll
work.
Work.
So people want emotional payments, right or wrong. You know, they don't want to be manipulated. And I said this sort of half-jokingly, but they want you to pay attention
mm-hmm.
to what they're feeling. Not say you're right, not to tell them to calm down, but they want you to pay attention to what they're feeling. And so when the NFL strikes or when the Writers Guild strikes, etc., what they need, each side, is not threats, is not walking out, but some notion that what they say has, or union management, has some value to it. Otherwise, you're just going to fight with each other for a long time and spend a lot of money.
Well, union negotiations and strikes are a great example of this, but how common is the perception that giving even a little to the other side somehow will open the floodgates and then one's own side gets steamrolled?
I think that perception is all over the place. And
mm-hmm.
so what Getting More also says is have a firm grasp of the obvious and say it. So I might say, you know, I perceive that if I give you an inch, you're going to take a mile. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I want to say what's going on in negotiation. People like it when you're straight with them. They don't necessarily have to have you agree with them, but they certainly want you to, they're certainly appreciative of saying what's going on. How come we don't trust each other? Why aren't we getting along? I never give my kid, my 9-year-old kid, Alexander, timeouts.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to talk to him about his perceptions. In fact, Alexander gives me timeouts. He says, Dad, give me a timeout. I'm tired of talking to you. Okay, so I say, Alexander, I'm your biggest fan. Let's talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so by getting in there and finding out what's really troubling them, you can have a much better relationship and get a lot more from the other side.
And you also stress that it's important not to, you know, so many times we think if I can just pull out a trump card at the last minute that I've had up my sleeve, then I will win. But you say be straight about your goals from the beginning and don't try to manipulate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you pull a fast one on somebody, you might get away with it today, but you if if they're still alive, to come and ask you tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You better not turn your back. And that's something that people often don't understand. You know, negotiation's a long game, as it were. It's a long process. And if you lose your reputation, if you get a reputation for doing things like that, people will remember it forever. You know, you overbill in a law firm, you know, you're known as the law firm that overbills if the client catches you, and you're known as that for the next 20 years,
mm-hmm.
even if you just do it once. So I want to be really careful about hosing the other party, because there are, in fact, repercussions. Let me mention something else that's really timely for today. A study in France some years ago showed that there's so much mistrust in France that gross national product is 5% lower and unemployment is 8% higher.
Hmm.
And this was before the U.S. recession. I believe that the U.S. Now fits into that category. So if you want to look at the issue of jobs and you want to look at the issue of gross national product, you've also got to look at what's happened to trust among institutions in the last few years, trust among employers and workers, and how that actually affects the ability of people to get jobs and to grow revenue.
So are you a proponent of trust but verify?
I think I'm always a proponent of trust but verify. I think if there's not too much trust, you've got to do it incrementally. You want to take a little bit of risk, and you want to build on it. And, of course, the more trust you have, the less you have to verify. If you're married and in love with somebody for 10 years, the verification process is less than a business partner, a business person that you just met. But I certainly want to think about the notion of trust, and I want to think about the notion of risk. We live in a fairly risky society in terms of perception, and that basically means that we have to ask more questions. There was a news story the other day about some writer, half Israeli, half Arab, and two men she didn't know that were looking suspicious according to someone else's perception, so they called out the F-16s, they arrested him, etc., and it was a whole big expensive hullabaloo over nothing because they were guilty of nothing. It seems to me that before you do that, you should ask a few questions.
Mm-hmm.
You should find out who these people are, that all people aren't the same, that letting your perceptions run wild and not questioning perceptions is expensive and can be dangerous, takes a long time, and overall does not contribute to the growth of the country's competitiveness.
We've talked a lot so far this hour about recognizing the emotions of the other side. What does it take to keep our own emotions in check so that we don't get distracted from what is the overall
sure.
goal?
First thing you need to do is recognize that emotions destroy negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm feeling emotional, I may be either the wrong negotiator or I need a break.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to try not to take things personally. Hard to do that, but try to think that that what they're trying to do to get me, to get my goat, as it were, is more about them than me. Next, I try to lower my expectations. Dashed expectations cause emotion. And so if I think that they're going to be straight with me and they're not, if I think they're going to be on time and they're not, I get emotional, I lose sight of my goals. And so if I lower my expectations, I'm never disappointed and I'm often pleasantly surprised. And so that's another thing that I want to do. I want to think about the notion that if I'm emotional, I'm not getting anywhere. It takes discipline to do that. But I've got to do it. In the Middle East, the wrong people are negotiating. You had some news on the Middle East. The U.S. is going over there to try to fix things. You know what they need in the Middle East? They need lunch in the Middle East.
Hmm.
They need to get to know each other, and then they need to get the right people negotiating, which is to say the hundreds of thousands of Arabs and Jews who already work together in Israel. They're doing just fine. There's already peace for a lot of people in the Middle East. The leaders with their constituencies and their political issues are all pretty emotional, and that's not a climate in which they can actually ever reach a deal.
Stuart Diamond is my guest. He's a negotiation expert and professor at the Wharton School of Business. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called Getting More: How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. We'll be back in a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is negotiation expert Stuart Diamond. He's a professor at the Wharton School of Business and Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called Getting More: How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. If you've got a question or want to share an example, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Stuart, you mentioned this yourself. In the Arab-Israeli negotiations, there are, in addition to the things they really have to disagree over, there are all kinds of internal squabbles and issues with the constituency. Certainly, we had this happening with almost anything that takes place in Congress, but recently with the debt ceiling crisis. What does it take to get everybody on board so that at least the members of each opposing side are in this together?
It takes a small step. Mm-hmm. A little step everybody agrees on. In the debt crisis, instead of talking about how much they disagreed, they should have said that they already agree on $1 trillion worth of savings. They're already 25% there. Mm-hmm. The next thing they should do is start with the easy things like the government accountability offices, waste and fraud, and then they should go from there. And so you want to start with the easy things. They shouldn't be starting with Palestinian statehood. 30 years ago when I first proposed this, they should have started with one factory that Arabs and Jews both worked at. And so they should start with, for example, what's a good example? Take 1 square mile of East Jerusalem and make it into the Palestinian capital. That's what the Vatican's got in Rome to run the whole Catholic religion worldwide. And in return for 3 Arab embassies, putting their embassies in Israel and recognition by the Palestinians, the Palestinians get a capital. And then they get 10 square miles for everything else that happens in Israel's favor. It's a trade. Life is about quid pro quo. And if you look for things to trade, most people don't. Items that you evaluate unequally, the better off you're going to be. It's much more and broader than win-win. It's about all the synapses that people have. And this is something which is not very well understood, but I wanted to give you a couple of examples if I could.
Sure.
The CEO of a major company in Philadelphia once told me the most important thing he ever did for his major client in a 20-year relationship was to pick up the client CEO's mother-in-law at the Philadelphia airport one Saturday night. It's got nothing to do with any deal, but it affects every deal. A guy from Google in California, one of my clients, said that he once couldn't close a multimillion-dollar deal, found out that the customer's daughter was having computer problems, teenage daughter, invested half a day, went over to the guy's house, tutored the daughter, fixed the computer, got the deal. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do with the deal itself, but was talked about the broader needs. I'm amazed when families fight over where they're going to go on vacation this year. Unless they're all going to die this year, there is next year. And there is all kinds of things that you trade. In my own family, my wife loves to garden, and she especially loves to garden with me. I hate to garden, and I especially hate to garden with my wife, because she's entirely too bossy. Mm-hmm. But I will garden with my wife almost any time she asks in return for 3 uninterrupted hours in front of the television set any time during the year a professional football game happens to be on. Hmm. So I'm open for trade. I trade, if I can go on a little bit, I trade with my son. I got a 9-year-old. What I'm doing often with him is I'm giving him stuff that he hasn't asked for, but I know he wants. Kids don't have a lot of power. He can pick the restaurants. He can leave his room a little dirty. He can go to bed a little later. You know why? Because now Alexander is in a constant debtor position with me. He always owes me stuff. And so now when I say, will you do this for Daddy? And he says, no. I say, didn't Daddy do this, this, and this for you? And when he says, when people say, aren't you manipulating your son? I sat down with him and I asked him that, and he said, no, I get stuff. So it's perfectly fine with the kid. I traded him minutes of Scooby-Doo for minutes of piano. And he played the piano because he played for cartoons. Now, it's a bribe if it's an ice cream cone a day. It's not a bribe if it's an ice cream cone every 3 weeks. Adults work for bonuses and salary, too. So it's just a way of treating the other party, of thinking about them, as I said, and their perceptions that get you a lot farther than the usual way.
And you point out here that because kids are usually the ones who have less bargaining power, at least when they're dealing with adults, they're really good at understanding the emotional state of the adults they're going to be dealing with.
That's exactly right. Kids watch other people really carefully. And part of what I do in Getting More is I get adults to watch kids negotiate and learn something from that. When you have not much raw power, you learn to deal more effectively with others. When kids grow up and get a baseball bat, they lose that ability. That's why kids are better than adults at this. But if you watch people carefully, you can often figure out what they need. And that's why I tend to do deals backwards than most people. Somebody says, what's your proposal? I say, I have no idea. What's in the deal? What are your needs? How can I possibly make a proposal unless I know what your needs are? And so I tend to do it backwards from most people because once I find out their needs, and if they won't tell me, I'll guess, then I make a proposal that's much more precise and likely to be approved.
And do you actually say to them, this is what I think you're wanting?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm right, they'll be happy. If I'm wrong, they'll tell me.
Yeah.
Again, this is a conversation with somebody else. It's not a debate. It's not a contest. Another, I think, really good example that people know about is the writer's strike in 2008, where nobody got any new programs on television. This process was used to solve the writer's strike. I was called by Ari Emanuel, who's probably the most prominent agent in Hollywood and is the role model for the agent on Entourage, a TV show, is a brother of Rahm Emanuel, who was then White House Chief of Staff, now Mayor of Chicago. And the writers have been on strike for 3 months, no contract for a year. And Ari wanted to know about, kind of help with royalty rates and other stuff. So I got on the phone with the negotiator for the Writers Guild and a lot of others, and I said, forget all this substantive stuff. Go to one of the interminable meetings with the studio heads that you're going to go to in a couple of days and ask them three questions. Question number one, you guys happy? We're not happy. Question number two, you making any money? We're not making any money. Question number three, if you had to do this over again, how would you do it? It took 30 minutes to restart the negotiations. It took 2 days to get a deal. Because they made this into a common problem that they commiserated with the other side. Now, I can say a couple of things about this that apply to all the tools in Getting More, or most of them, which is, one, it's not rocket science, and two, unless you already know how to do it, it's completely invisible. So this is a real competitive advantage for people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now, and we have Kieran on the line in the Colony. Hi, Kieran.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I do have a very, very, I don't know how to put it. I think it's a very common question. Everybody goes through it in everyday, you know, day-to-day life. Okay, I have been working in my team for about 5-6 years now, and it's about time for me to get a promotion. And I actually asked my boss about it, and what he said the other day that was, well, if I give you a promotion, you have to stay in my team for another 2 years. I can't let you go. But I don't want to stay in the same team. I want to grow my career and actually, you know, pursue other things and whatnot. How do I go by asking him a promotion and not staying in the same team, which I deserve, basically? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, good question. I want to know about their standards, how they make decisions. I first want to know, is the promotion is staying in your team for X number of years the only possible way to get a promotion? What if I generate more value for your team and you look better? What if there's a project or two I work on that really helps you? Are there any other dreams or fears that you have that I can plug into and help you out here? And so what your boss is essentially saying to you is, if you give me a certain amount of additional value, I will give you a certain amount of additional value. And he named one option. And so I want to know, are there any other options? There may not be, but you need to ask the question. And that's how you'd start that.
And I guess it's helpful to know why they want the 2 years.
Yes, exactly. What if you were responsible for finding your own replacement? So your boss is essentially saying, I want somebody like you in this job for X number of years. So you might say, what if I stay in this job for a certain period of time, find and train my replacement, and they're just like me? So those are the, in other words, most people, if you start with, they don't think about this enough. If you start with, what are they really saying here? It'll give you ideas for creative options.
Talk about, Kieran's question was about getting a promotion. There's also the sort of gut-wrenching process by which some people have to go and ask for a raise. And you are very much behind the idea of incremental progress rather than walking into a meeting and walking out with a big raise.
Exactly. I should say, just as a plug, that the Wall Street Journal blog said that this was the most important book to read for your career this year, because it has a lot of things like that. And the first thing I want to talk about is that most employers don't want to pay for past work unless there were clear criteria that you exceeded, because past work's been budgeted and paid for. What I want to do is I want to say to my boss, what are the criteria to get a raise in the future, and how can I meet them? And people are, and your employers are willing often to be much more generous if you have a value equation in the future than paying for the past. And so it'll differentiate you. It'll cause the boss to think about something really clearly in terms of a trade for value, and it will enable you to have a greater chance of getting a raise. The second thing is if I can't get the whole raise I want, can I get some part of it that shows that I'm creating some value? The next thing is are there some intangibles that I can get if you can't pay me money? Does the school have, workplace have educational loans or grants so I can improve my skill set and be eligible for a raise? Can they help me arrange a loan or refinancing of my mortgage to drive the interest rate down or get some more money in a home equity loan? So there's all kinds of things that companies may have done for people in the past that I could ask for in lieu of money. I also want to ask what the company is afraid of and what do they need. What are the things that they in particular value? Maybe it's working some particular time of day or year. Maybe it's a contact in a certain area. Maybe it's a skill in a certain area you can learn on your own time. You know, all those kind of things. The next thing I also want to do is I want to talk to people, if I can find them, throughout the organization and who used to be in the organization, and ask them for information on what they did to get raises and promotions. So I want to cast the net a little more widely, and I want to make relationships with people in other parts of the organization so I can get more information on how the organization makes decisions. It's not as burdensome in terms of time and work as it seems, because each time you ask the question, you'll become stronger in your ability to be persuasive.
I imagine, Stuart, that there are people listening to our conversation who say, well, that's fine if you work for a small company or an informal organization, but I work for a place that has rules about when you get a raise and when you get this vacation. You, though, have multiple examples throughout the book of rules that are bent or broken, including things like getting discounts on things and keeping a warranty after products have expired.
Right. Since it's in the book, I might as well say it. You know, I meet people at Wharton all the time, partners from McKinsey, and they swear to me that McKinsey treats all people the same. And I got dozens of students who got raises and bonuses out of new jobs out of McKinsey when they don't even know it. Not a lot of their names are in the book for various reasons, but the anecdotes are detailed. And so there are exceptions. I want to ask for exceptions, whether it is getting my flight changed at no cost, or whether it's a raise or a bonus. You know, the company or a later check-in at a hotel, people have rules, but they also have exceptions to rules. So it should be hardwired to people's brain that every time they tell you it's a rule, whether it's the insurance company or the doctor, whoever, ask, have there ever been exceptions, and fit within one of the exceptions. And that's true in store. Have they ever given a discount? Under what circumstances? So those are the kind of things you can ask. I send my students out, and I make them do this from day one, and they come back with astonishing discounts, 25, 50, 75%. And they get cases where somebody says, you know, I can't give you a discount, but I can give it to you for free. And so you want to ask for those things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak this time with Paul in Plano. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is about misperceptions. We've been talking a lot today about perceptions. What about misperceptions, stereotypes that prevent you from getting past first base?
That's such a good question. We're doing some new research, only some of which is in the book, that finds that only 20% of the of the people that we've tested so far get their identity from race, religion, gender, and nationality. 80% of people get their identity from individualistic traits, such as I'm a woman with a small child, I'm a golfer, I like to sing opera, etc. So that if you use traditional stereotypes to try to make connections with people, you're wrong 80% of the time. And so therefore, I need to find out what their perceptions are. There are Muslims who like Jews more than some Jews. There are you know, all kinds. The externalities aren't so useful anymore for determining what people's perceptions are, and so we get misperceptions all the time. And that, I think, is finding out the misperceptions by asking more questions is one of the key success factors for this century: who's different and who's not. And one of the really good examples that I use in getting more is if you were a Jew in Poland, to use that religion again, in 1944, and you thought the Nazis were monolithic, and you met Oskar Schindler, you lost your life. Because you didn't realize that Schindler, although a Nazi, was willing to save your life, but you never asked him because you thought all Nazis hated Jews. What a source of competitive advantage it is to know who's really the same and who's really different. You may have something more in common with somebody in Mongolia whose language you don't even speak than somebody who's just next to you at work. So you need to ask the question.
And I guess it works both ways. You could also assume someone will be on your side and they might not.
That's exactly right. It doesn't start with the substantive issue. It doesn't start with rational interest-based negotiation. It starts with what's the picture in their head at the moment of the negotiation. And you should not assume you know it. You got to find it out.
Negotiation expert Stuart Diamond is a professor at the Wharton School of Business and Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The New York Times. His new book is called Getting More: How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. Join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with negotiation expert Stuart Diamond about his new book, Getting More: How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. So, Stuart, I think everybody knows this. There are people that, despite our overtures toward empathy and our willingness to compromise in a negotiation, they are just, I was about to say pit bulls, but we did a show a couple weeks ago about how we shouldn't stereotype all pit bulls, but they are just vicious. They're just nasty. What do you do with these people that won't respond at all in kind to your attempts to be decent?
The first thing you have to decide is whether you're the right negotiator. They love somebody.
Yeah.
Maybe you're the wrong negotiator. In fact, my choice of negotiator has got to be the person most likely to get the other side to do what I want. And so you may be the wrong negotiator. Maybe the most experienced person is not the right negotiator, but it's the person that will soften up the other side. That's an inquiry. The second thing is you want to use standards with them. Well, you're here for a reason, probably, that you want to make a deal. You want to be incremental. And so, therefore, what's troubling you in getting you not to want to make a deal, except in a way that you insult me? So you want to call out bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You want to use third parties that will make them appear extreme, is another way to do it. So the two best uses 100 years were Gandhi and Martin Luther King. You never want to make yourself the issue. Like, why are you screaming at us? We think you're wonderful. So if they're hard bargainers, you want to give them a megaphone. You want them to make themselves the issue. Gandhi took away the jewel in the crown from the British Empire, India, without ever raising his voice or ever raising a weapon. Martin Luther King got the civil rights movement started by simply saying, you know, this is the U.S. Constitution. Would you say you're being consistent with it or not? And so very, very powerful to ask them a series of questions. And people see in our society, when others get extreme, they tend to get discarded. I think that Obama probably won the 2008 election in the second debate. When every time it looked like McCain was going to haul off and slug him, Obama just smiled graciously, offered his hand, which McCain didn't take. And if you looked at the trend lines, they were all down. People didn't like that. Now, he has made himself the issue a little bit in the debt debate by walking out and so forth. But he needs, if he wants to be more successful, he needs to go back to the way he did it before. You don't ever want to make yourself the issue in a hard bargain situation. You want them to make themselves the issue. Did you know we called you 22 times? We apologize for not doing this right. How should we do it? People can't withstand those kind of questions.
We have an email here from Genesis in Arlington who writes that she's a young woman living with her boyfriend whose monthly income is a significant amount less than hers. She says, we're responsible for our own personal expenses and share household expenses and bills. I believe the rent should be split 50-50. He disagrees and pays 20% of the total.
Okay, well, I guess the question, the basic question is, in return for what? First of all, what's our standard? How do we decide? What's the total contribution that each party makes to the relationship, and how should that be balanced? In other words, let's assume that I want my boyfriend to pay half of the rent. My question is, I want to change the status quo in return for what? Or is the relationship out of balance now? Do I do all the housework? Do I pay for other stuff, too, that he should pay for? Maybe he doesn't want to pay half the rent, but maybe he'll do all the housework. So I don't want to just limit it to the current discussion at hand. I want to look at the whole relationship and who does what for whom and balance it out that way.
Could they look for a cheaper apartment?
They certainly could do that. That's a very, very good idea. I didn't suggest that because moving is a hassle, but that's also another creative option.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Raj in Plano. Hello, Raj.
Hi, Chris. I'm a big fan and listen to your show all the time. I had the pleasure of listening to Professor Diamond a couple of weeks ago when he was here in town. But I had one question. When do you know when to stop? When do you know enough is enough?
That's another really good question. My flip answer is when they're in a taxi and you're chasing them down the street. my better answer is, with practice, you'll get an instinct for it. You've tried everything and you can't think of anything else. Most people stop too soon. And so Getting More has a whole list of things. Have you asked them what their needs were? Have you tried third parties? Have you used standards? Have you tried to give them emotional payments? When you go through your whole checklist and there's nothing left, then it's probably time to leave. But as I said, a lot of people, they do other things and they quit too soon. I'd like, just because it's on my mind, although it's a little far afield, I really like to use the Libyan example. In Libya, everybody's congratulating themselves that Gaddafi is out. Well, the guy said he was negotiable 6 months ago. Instead of negotiating with him, 50,000 Libyans got killed and $10 billion got spent. When 30 years ago, Idi Amin left Uganda when Saudi Arabia offered him a villa and a few million dollars. And so the parties quit that negotiation process too soon, and it was really expensive. Again, which is not to say you can't find another way to reach a deal, but I think you need to go through the whole checklist, and the longer and better the checklist you have, the more likely you'll get a deal for cheaper, quicker, easier.
How do you deal with the reality that pride is an impediment to some people resolving conflict?
You give people emotional payments. The next time a policeman stops you for a traffic infraction, apologize and thank them for doing their job. They're invested in this job. They've got a lot of pride. They want you to acknowledge that they're the boss, and so you do it. Because my goal is to meet my goals. I don't care if you have more pride. I don't care if I have to insult you to flatter you. I was once on a TV station in Philly where the host said, after I said this, I don't want to kiss their butt. And I said, you want to meet your goals or not? And so the question is, what am I about here? And so, you know, pride, certainly a pride goeth before a fall, they say. Pride is a detriment to negotiation if you feel it to meet your goals. But if somebody else, if I know they need pride, they need to have an emotional payment, and they'll pay me in return.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Mark in Hearst. Hey, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
I'm kind of one of several, I guess, almost 9,000 pilots in America. Airlines, obviously the major employer here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We've been in negotiations now for over 5 years, and our situation is kind of awkward because it's kind of obvious that there's a lot of high-priced consultants working for American Airlines, and they're telling them, you know, keep stalling, keep stalling, keep stalling, and we're in a situation where we all, quote, pull together to win together. Way back in 2003, we took 40-50% pay cuts, and in my case, 100% pay cut. And we're just not making any progress. So the question becomes, if there's a question about veracity or negotiating in good faith, what do you do?
Yes. Well, first of all, you know, for millions of years, the Earth was flat, then it was round. So you have a lot of people probably hired by as consultants who don't know what they're talking about, but they're mouthing something they read somewhere or that they think works. You're not going to change that overnight. What you need to do is find a small group of people on the other side who see a better way to do it and expand from there. Since you've been doing this for 7 years already, it's not going to take you a month to fix this, but start small. Start with some people who see there's a better, more incremental way, and then gradually try to increase and scale from there. This is exactly how the technology industry adds value. That's where I'd start. I wouldn't try to do everything at once. I wouldn't try to have a position at once. I'd just try to find some people who want to have a better way of dealing with each other, because it starts with an attitude. Are the pilots and the airline enemies? Are they combatants? Or is there some way for them to work together to build more for all of them?
When you talk, Stuart, about the importance of not rehashing past conflicts, if I was someone like Mark and years ago I took a large pay cut, it would be hard not to focus on that to the exclusion of getting anything resolved
future. And that doesn't work because, you know, if you want to fight over yesterday, you've got war, litigation, or no deal. Negotiations about tomorrow. I can't change yesterday. I can't fix what happened yesterday. Effective negotiators know to ask, what do we do now? And that adds value. Focusing on tomorrow is the thing that adds value. And so the people that are focusing on the past, send them into a room and let them have a debate all day. Meanwhile, I'm going to focus on how we add value tomorrow. It's a much better, less stressful, more value-laden question to ask.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Clay on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Clay.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Really interesting subject. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I've got about 1,000 comments on this subject, but I'll just make a quick one. I am self-employed and have been for about 6 or 7 years, and I've worked in a variety of fields as a self-employed person. And I have to say that the efficacy of these techniques works at every level, and for the self-employed and for the corporate and everything. And one of my former business partners who really had a great sense of people told me, you know, if you just shut your mouth and listen to what the customers are telling you, they'll tell you everything you need to know in order to make them happy and in order to make you happy. And I've used it over and over again, and it works. And I'm looking forward to reading the book. Thank you very much.
That's what you said is exactly right. In addition to teaching, I've had my own entrepreneurial ventures in aviation, medical services, agriculture, energy, technology, finance, etc. And it took me a while to realize this as a manager, but I eventually realized that even though I run the company, I don't have all the good ideas. that the people who work for me that are often in the trenches often have better, more timely, more focused ideas, and the more I consult them, the more motivated they'll be and the better ideas I'll get.
So Clay is using some of these ideas to generate business for himself. What do you say to people who are looking for a job in this economy?
I want to find out what I can do to fulfill the employer's dreams and meet their fears. I had a guy, Mahul Trivedi, in my class who got rejected by 18 firms, took the class to get job offers, and I said, fine, let's go back to the same 18 firms. He said, with respect for this time, you're crazy. I said, well, let's see about that. I want you to find out the needs and fears of every person in every department that you want to talk to and write 18 different resumes. There is no one-size-fits-all. There's just a bunch of people in departments with different needs. Well, he gave up after 12 offers and 6 final interviews. It was so easy to do because he focused specifically on the people, on the individuals involved. I'm an employer. I hire people. Once every 2 years do I get a resume focused on me. And so this is really good advice for people in the job market.
And so what do people need to do to find that information? Is it acceptable to make a few phone calls?
I will ask the HR department of the company or people who interview me, what are your needs? I mean, I don't want to waste your time. I want to respect you. So I'd like to focus my proposal on what your needs are. So that means you might want to have 2 interviews, an informational interview and a real interview. Ask people who used to work at the firm. Ask people who still work at the firm. Do research on the Internet. There's a lot of information there that you can find out. Even if you're wrong in what you've concluded, people will appreciate the effort you went to. And as an employer, I will say, hey, this is someone that put some muscle into feeling, into trying to figure out what my company's about. That means we'll be a good employee. And so it also sends a really good subliminal message to the other side.
And so the focus there is on the skills that you have for the job rather than simply what you've done in the past.
That's exactly right. That's another – I'm really glad you brought that up. Experience is a proxy for skill, and it's not usually – it's not often a perfect proxy. So I advise people to figure out the skills they want and pitch yourself on that if you don't have the experience. Because – and then say, well, I don't have experience in your field, but I've got these skills you can use, and here's why they would fit. And so even in changing sectors, industry sectors, you can be persuasive.
Are you hoping to keep this book out of the hands of your 9-year-old at least for a few more years?
Well, that's too late. As soon as I brought the galleys when he took the book to school, read the kids' chapters. It's too late for that. But I'm happy that he learns negotiation skills. I might not want to share my bank account with my counterpart, but I certainly want to share this process because it's the process that gets more for everyone.
Negotiation expert Stuart Diamond is a professor at the Wharton School of Business and a Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter for The New York Times. His new book is called Getting More, How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. Stuart, it's been such an interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.